Good morning.
Good morning. May it please the Court, Jennifer Levin Eichhorn on behalf of the United States.
All right, you have 5 minutes, but we'll, if we have more questions. Now, my understanding is that you have asked to be heard on the issue that the district court's finding in terms of that regarding the statute, and you're saying that the Department of Education has, because it's ambiguous, has made certain interpretations, and you're entitled to deference of a sort. Is that correct?
That's correct. There are three issues that we're here to address. The first is that the Department of Education's interpretation that a child's impairment can fall within more than one category of disability is appropriate and consistent with the statute in a way to assess potential eligibility. The second point is that the regulatory definition of other health impairment includes a list of possible conditions and is not exhaustive. And third, that auditory processing disorder, depending on the extent of the condition that a child has, can qualify as an auditory processing disorder. So going back to the first point.
But you're saying that now. That wasn't, you've spoken to ADD previously, but it wasn't, you really didn't speak to auditory processing previously, did you?
That's correct. We have not. But this Court has recognized, and the Supreme Court has recognized, that positions presented by the United States in amicus briefs can be considered as a, even when it's raised for the first time in amicus, when the Court is assessing what and giving deference to those views in terms of interpreting statutes and regulations. And we're asking for that here. Because the statute and because the regulations are ambiguous, we're saying that the district court was wrong in saying that if auditory processing disorder is considered a serious learning disability, it can't possibly also be another health impairment.
Okay. Now, special learning disability has to be a severe discrepancy due to disorder or basic psychological process and cannot be otherwise ameliorated. Other health impairment has to be limited strength, vitality, or alertness due to chronic acute health problems adversely affects child's educational performance, right? So they're a little bit different.
The language is different, but it doesn't mean something can't fall within one
another.
That it can
be both.
It can be both.
But it could be one or the other as well.
That's true. Not every learning disability is going to meet the criteria for other health impairment, for sure.
But your problem is the district court said that it can't be both.
That's correct. And it said it can't be both and didn't assess whether or not auditory processing disorder can be can meet the criteria of other health impairment. I'd also point out that the definitions that you're reading are those that were in effect in 2005, and the severe discrepancy requirement is no longer in place. But I understand for purposes of this, you need to address
that. But, counsel, what would we do with the scenario if we were to agree with your argument as a matter of law, but took the view that the record as it now exists would not support the other health impairment category? What would we do in that scenario from your point of view? Do you think it would be appropriate to make that legal determination even though the record would not support the proposition that the school district somehow acted unreasonably back in 2005 in not making that determination?
We're not addressing whether or not I'm frankly I'm not sure I understand your question.
Now, if you're not supporting the plaintiff's position on what happened back then, you are saying that the district judge was wrong on the statute.
Right.
But what the judge is asking you here is if we, all right, can we then look back at what the record was back in, 2004 or whatever,
right,
and say, hey, that record there is not sufficient to establish an other health impairment.
That may be. I mean, we haven't weighed in on whether or not this child meets the
right
standards. That we frequently participate as amicus to address the legal questions without addressing the specific
application. So you would want us, if we were to agree with you in the law, you would want us just to remand on that basis alone for the
that it's frankly
I thought you were asking that.
Say that again?
I thought you do take that position.
We did ask for remand. I believe that there are instances when this Court has resolved IDEA questions when it's had.
But what if looking, okay, it's going to be really hard to go back and recreate that, you know, that the school district was in a position to evaluate what it had at the time. All right, so if we remanded it and essentially said, okay, now determine, now that we've told you, you were wrong under saying it couldn't be an OHI as well.
Right.
How do you recreate, you know, how, so then do they get to add now and put it back in the 2004?
In terms of making the assessment, the court or the school district can look at the evidence that it had with respect to what was the child's problems, what were his needs, and how are they being addressed, and use that same evidence to evaluate whether or not he fits the category of SLD or if he fits the category of other health impairment. Having this consideration of more than one category isn't going to be particularly burdensome or costly or time-consuming for a school district in most instances, because when you're making an assessment under Child Find and you are looking at what are the child's problems, what are his needs, and what's being provided in the classroom.
Okay, I think we know all that, but we'll work. Okay, let's just assume that we agree with you.
Okay.
On that. Let's just assume that for this purpose. But if we remand it, it wouldn't be mutually exclusive to say that the school district did not abuse its discretion back on what they had at that particular time, correct?
Right.
One doesn't follow the other. Just our agreeing with you on the statute doesn't necessarily mean that the plaintiff wins back on that hearing back then.
That's correct. It might be that this child's condition hasn't manifested in a degree to which the extent to which he has auditory processing disorder meets the other health impairment category.
So it's possible. My understanding is eventually they find he eventually got services and now he's over 18. But my understanding of disabilities is you probably always have them, but at the point that you're entitled to services, it's a moving. A child might be okay in first, second, and third grade, but suddenly in fourth grade, whatever their OHI or their SLD,
learning disability,
then either causes the discrepancy or it's causing the other requirements of the OHI. But it's possible that it didn't manifest itself earlier, right?
It's possible.
I mean, is the school district, do they have to, is this child finding, if you ever found it later, they were wrong that they didn't find it sooner? Does one necessarily follow?
I don't think there's a categorical answer for that. I think in most instances, a child is going to that has a disability that's identified later likely had it earlier.
But does that mean that the school district violated Child Find at a particular point if the evidence was not there?
If the evidence was not there, we're not going to say we haven't addressed that.
Yeah, you're here with respect to the interpretation of the statute.
Yes.
Is that correct? And we appreciate your being here. The district court said, without having the benefit of your views, said that other health impairments seem to refer to different kinds of conditions, and that Congress couldn't have intended the same condition to be evaluated under two different standards. Now, what is wrong with that?
A few things, Your Honor. First is the court narrowly interpreted health conditions to simply mean traditional physical medical problems like epilepsy, leukemia. The regulations had been amended by the time of this case to include ADD and ADHD, which, because of the hypersensitivity to stimuli, that was added. That falls within the category of health problems. And in 2006, the department added Tourette syndrome as another condition that falls within other health impairment. So the phrase chronic or acute health problems goes beyond simply medical. And again, this list is not exhaustive. And
right.
The department has determined that that is
that, so. That goes to part of it. But what about
and
the...
And why it can't
why,
be both?
Why do you have these two different standards?
That There are a handful of conditions which manifest itself in a wide variety of ways. So it is possible, for example, with ADD, that a child may have the limited alertness, which would fall within OHI. But nothing stops it from being considered part of specific learning disability. The department has said it can fall within specific learning disability. It could even fall within emotional disturbance. Chronic fatigue syndrome is another type of condition which can manifest itself in a variety of ways. Auditory processing disorder can manifest in a variety of ways. And the goal of Child Find is to identify whether or not that condition meets the criteria and the child needs special education. And I'd also add that the use of the term or doesn't mean mutually exclusive and categorically separate.
Counsel, your position arguably greatly adds to the burden of local school districts that are trying to comply with this already very complicated law? I mean, they have to have a sense of what the claim of disability is, what's the nature of the disability, in order to establish that from their perspective they're providing the adequate services. If in fact any number of these categories could be applicable in any given situation, that makes it much more difficult for the districts to do their job and make their case that they're doing their job.
This is not going to happen in a large number of cases. Frankly, there's only a handful of conditions, and we've only just come up with three so far, which can fall within more than one category. And again, a school is going to make its assessment under Child Find by looking at the child's needs. Once it's identified what the child needs and what his problems are, it's just a matter of looking at the category and saying, okay, does it meet the criteria of learning disability by being some kind of psychological disorder? And if not, you're using that same information to look at whether or not it might fall within other health impairment. There are not going to be a lot of children who are going to require this more than one. And frankly, by the time they modify the definition of significant specific learning disability to eliminate the severe discrepancy requirement, there would not have been the two-category assessment needed.
Well, essentially, it's another arrow in a quiver to help a child that's clearly struggling but might only have a 20-point discrepancy, but they're clearly struggling and they meet the criteria of the OHI, right?
Right.
So, but you're saying there's not too many, the comorbidity isn't going to be great.
Exactly. It's not going to be a large fraction of children. It's not going to open the floodgates of children who need special education. But it is going to help identify those who do appropriately fall within the category.
Are you saying that this severe requirement is not there anymore?
That's correct.
So that this is a... When was that change made?
I believe in 2006. That it might have been later. I'm frankly not sure.
All right. But obviously the district courts are struggling with this, and so even though you think you may have been clear, it probably hasn't been that clear to everyone. So what you're saying is you would like Chevron deference, and you would like us to say what you're saying, so that the district courts don't keep getting it wrong. Is that am I summing it up for you?
That would work, Your Honor.
Okay. Any other questions? Okay. All right. The appellant now has 15 minutes, and that includes your rebuttal time, too.
Good morning, Your Honors.
You want to reserve any time for rebuttal?
If I could reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Okay. And your name is?
Mandy Lee, and I represent EM, and I have represented him since 2004. A question that was raised was, what information did the school have about EM at the time that would have qualified him for specific learning disability or under the category of other health impaired? In our briefs, we outlined numerous pages from the transcript that identified a child who was in a daze, as reported by his teachers, in class for 2 grade years, fourth and fifth grade, that he was performing below grade standards, that he had listening comprehension issues, that he was not paying attention, and that he was only being passed from grade to grade by virtue of a waiver. This is not information that was absent to the school district. They had this, and they documented in their assessment in 2004.
Let's cut to the chase. Let's say if we agree that the Department of Education is entitled to Chevron deference, then they said they're not here for you to win, right? They're here to say what they think the statute says and their interpretation of it for school districts. So they did request, I think, a remand, as my colleague said initially. But if we remand it, is it on the record that was before the ALJ and the court back then, or are you planning to try to augment it with the fact of he was subsequently diagnosed and this is where he is right now? That wouldn't tell us where he was back then, right? Because for the school district to be found to have not followed the child find, wouldn't it have to be based on what was in front of them back then?
Well, child find is one issue, whether they failed to identify.
Well, we have the WIS thing, but let me, on the OHI.
Eligibility is what you're talking about.
Yes.
Well,
can we just look at it and decide whether it's there or not?
Absolutely, and the court did. The court found that EM performed poorly in school at 652 F3rd 999. The court found that in the third and fourth grades he struggled. His teachers identified attention and homework completion as problem areas. The court also found that interventions.
Okay, but OHI, you have to show there has to be evidence of more than that. And so.
Limited vitality and alertness.
But are you saying you're not going to, you would just go by what was presented back then? You're not augmenting it with anything?
I believe that the augmentation of the 2007 JOC report and the 2008 report that the school district finding him eligible.
That wasn't before them at that time. So how can they have done something wrong by something that happens later? Don't you have to do it based on back then?
Well, we believe they did do something wrong. They discounted valid scores that met 20 U.S.C. 1414.
Okay, but that's not the OHI. That's the separate argument.
Right. So under OHI, at the time, the definition is unchanged. Limited vitality and alertness. That was caused by a chronic or acute health condition. And that the most important piece is that that limited vitality and alertness affected educational performance. Well, this court, in its order, already determined that there was an affect on educational performance by saying that he failed for 2 years. And the court also had information that he was in a daze, as reported by his teachers.
What was in the record back then of the auditory processing?
That Dr. Ruth Casper diagnosed EM with an auditory processing disorder and that his disorder was so severe that she had to stop testing in
order to come. What
year was that?
What year was that?
That was in 2004, and it was admitted as part of the due process hearing. That's when the district admitted evidence from Jody Winselberg, an audiologist who never met EM, who couldn't rule out that he had an auditory processing disorder. So at any time during the due process hearing, the school district could have said, you know what, he does have an auditory processing, but there's one more piece of information, Your Honor. When the Kaufman was given and when Ross Wright report in 2004, right when the IEPs were happening, which I was in attendance at, the Ross Wright report said he should be referred because he has audiological problems. In addition, if you did the discrepancy analysis on the Kaufman, which was administered by Leslie Vile, she found auditory weaknesses, and she also found a discrepancy significant, which was also found later in the Jacques report, so it was corroborated, in listening comprehension. So it's not like the district went blindly in 2004 and all of a sudden this was a shocker to them. They had a child who was struggling in school, a child who couldn't pass from grade to grade, and they had a discrepancy in listening comprehension on a valid assessment.
But, counsel, isn't it a fact that although the possibility that EM might have qualified under this OHI category, I mean, the focus before the ALJ and in the district court, what was this special learning disability category? I mean, that was the focus of the debate, and it seems that it's later in the long history of the case that this OHI category has become increasingly important. But that has, to me at least, it has the feel of a bit of an imposition on what was being done initially. And there may be some unfairness to the district in now sort of imposing this retrospective view on what was going on. I mean, that OHI was not the focus of the debate in the early stages of this case. Isn't that true?
That is not true. And that is not okay. What the Ninth Circuit, this Court found
right.
previously.
Right. It wasn't so waived.
The Ninth Circuit said you could raise it, but
right.
they didn't say it was the focus of the prior. So that is not, you're not, it's law of the case that it was, that they could discuss it on the appeal. But it isn't law of the case that it was fully briefed.
Sure. I'm happy to give you the two citations that I raised for Judge Noonan, Paez, and Bea, which form the crux of the remand on the issue of OHI. If you look
at... Well, what was law of the case? Law of the case is that you were able to argue it on appeal, that you had said enough to argue it on appeal.
And we did say
but
enough.
But not that the record was sufficient to find OHI.
Actually, what the Court found was that Judge Fogel and the ALJ did not address the issue of OHI, not that it wasn't raised. We absolutely argued it. It was defined for Judge Fogel. We went into great detail
the
about
attack the attack on appeal. Was it raised enough for the appellate court to address it? That's what's law of the case. They said you raised it enough for you to talk about it on appeal. They didn't say that the record was sufficient.
The defendants below from the due process complaint, I can even go back further to the IEP, all the way up through today, have extensively, there's been no miscarriage of justice or inability to defend the position that auditory processing disorders are not OHI. The OHI issue has been raised throughout the litigation. The defendants have put on ample evidence. They hired an expert who never even met EM to opine as to whether his auditory processing disorder qualified him at all under any category.
Would you concede that there can be, that just because a person is diagnosed later under SLD or OHI doesn't necessarily mean in the past that the school district didn't do what they had to do? Or is it always your position, if it turns up later, they must have been wrong before when they didn't get it?
Under the facts of this case, my position...
No, I didn't ask. That's okay. Not what I asked you. You don't get to answer what you want to answer. You answer the question I asked you.
I do not believe that that is always the case. And we actually provided case law, a case called GD. The district raised the concern that by allowing supplemental evidence to shed light on a record that might open up this floodgate. And actually, we cited cases where we conceded that the floodgate isn't always open. I mean, basically, there are instances where a child may have had a disabling condition. In this case, he had chronic ear infections since preschool, and the district knew that. He had a severe head injury. The district knew that. All of those things have, as Dr. Jacques pointed out, likely the result, what caused the neurobiological condition of the auditory processing disorder, as well as his learning disabilities. I would also say, under the facts of this case, and this point is critical, the discrepancy with the learning comprehension, which is an issue that we've cited and provided a lot of information for the court about how central auditory processing can affect a person's ability to listen, has never changed. The discrepancy existed. And I know I'm not confusing the issue of specific learning disability, but the testing that was done drew out this issue of listening. That discrepancy not only existed when Leslie Vile did her test in 2004 and when Roz Wright did her test, because she also found a discrepancy in listening, which is why she referred the school district, hey, he needs an audiological processing examination. You should have him referred out. And it's something we had been requesting for a very long time. It was also borne out by Dr. Casper's report. It was also borne out in Dr. Jacques' report. She found a discrepancy using the WISC-4, which is a different version of the test.
Well, on the SLD claim, if we were to find, and I'm not saying we are, this is another hypothetical. If we were to find that the use of the WISC, is that how you say that? WISC?
Yes. the Wexler
score was reasonable. If we were to find that, how can you prevail on that part of it?
A very straightforward answer to that. There are two or three parts to that. Number one is if the court below had read Dr. Wright's report, it said, my scores are unreliable because during the test administration, he was not paying attention. The other part of it is that when Leslie Vial did her assessment, that assessment met all of the criteria under 3030 as well as 20 U.S.C. 1414. Was it valid when it was administered? She definitively answered yes.
Well, that's all heard down there, right?
That's right.
Right. But so it's – and if someone resolves it, it's like when a jury hears two sides of it and they – you know, I was at home, you know, baking cookies, or you were at the robbery – you were at Jack in the Box at the window doing the robbery, and they hear both of it, but they decide I was at Jack in the Box doing the robbery. It's – they resolve against you on certain things. So the court – I mean, the fact finder heard all of that and decided that the WISC was the most reliable one.
But why did Leslie Vial look to the WISC? Because she said she felt that her scores were inflated. She read in a book somewhere that her scores might be inflated. And none of the testing that she did to corroborate that feeling supported her.
Okay. Do you want to save some time?
I'd like to save the 3 minutes.
Okay. Thank you. Well, you get 244.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Good morning.
Good morning.
May it please the Court. My name is Kimberly Smith. I represent the Pajaro Unified School District. I want to start on the issue of the statutory interpretation. I don't necessarily disagree with what the United States has argued. The school district has never, ever taken the position that disabilities can only be placed in one category. We just feel that
It went along with it down below when the Court saw it that way.
Well, so what way? I mean, there was never a determination.
Well, the Court said it can't be both.
Well, that was the decision that plaintiff appealed. I mean,
right,
that was the last decision.
Right, but you didn't – I don't think you fought that too much right there. That was you.
Well, I mean, I would just say the written decision we got wasn't even necessarily what we argued in our briefs.
Okay, so if we were to agree that the Department of Education is in charge of administering this, that they've now said that this is what it means and they're entitled to Chevron deference, they're not saying you lose in this case. They're
I'm
just
sure.
saying this is how the statute's – so –
Well, and that's the point.
But is that fine with you?
It is fine with me to say that, yes, certain disabilities can be found to fit into various categories. We know that from ADHD. It can fit under specific learning disability, under other health impairment, and even emotional disturbance, depending on how it manifests itself. But what we did argue in the remand, and which was really the first time that we had the chance to argue this issue, is that a central auditory processing disorder is not a health condition. It really doesn't affect the strength, vitality, and alertness of
the
student.
Right, but they're saying it is.
Well, that's the part I want to argue against.
All right, but they're the Department of Education. They're over you.
I know. That's
their job. It's not their job to run your school district or any. It's their job.
I'm confused about this.
Yes.
When did the Department of Education come in with this interpretation?
I believe on this appeal.
So
this EM2 appeal.
So the district court had nothing to defer to or no and so it seems odd to say that the district court erred in not giving deference to something that wasn't there.
Right. And that's the thing. We have no case law out there that has ever decided that a central auditory processing disorder qualifies as a health impairment. And what I argued to the district court, and I want to argue to the court today, is it really is not a medical and health condition as that statute anticipated. When you look at the things that fall under, like ADHD or chronic fatigue syndrome that was brought up, those are things that are treatable. You take medications.
So why should we, but now that we have to interpret the statute and the Department of Education is interpreting it, why should we accept your interpretation over someone that's not involved in the middle of litigation and they're interpreting it for everyone? It doesn't mean you lose on this case.
Okay.
It just means that's what the statute means going forward.
Well, if what I'm taking issue with, though, is there's no precedent for the U.S. government to say that specifically an auditory processing disorder
Except
qualifies under
Except that they're the government and they're in charge of interpreting the statute.
Well, what I didn't hear in the government's argument is why an auditory processing disorder affects a student's strength, vitality, and alertness. And going away from the statutory interpretation, if you look at specifically at this student, there was no evidence in the record that that was the case.
Well, counsel, I would say almost self-evidently, to the extent I understand what this auditory processing disorder is, it certainly can affect a student's alertness. If they're not able to process information in a traditional way, they're probably not as attentive, as alert to what's going on in the classroom as students who do not suffer from that disability. That doesn't seem like a stretch at all.
Well, I don't see it the way that you're describing it, because a processing disorder.
One second. It's a little bit distracting. The person in the back seat that keeps nodding your head in both different directions depending on what people are saying.
Go back to your question, and again, drawing the comparison between health conditions and processing disorders. A health condition like ADHD, you can treat with medication. The person, there's scores of cases out there where the person didn't qualify for special education because they got their attentive issues into control. An auditory processing disorder is not being fidgety. It's not getting up out of your seat necessarily. It's the fact that your brain cannot process information that you hear through your ears versus maybe what you read. Everybody has weaknesses and strengths in their brain. The reason that the auditory processing disorder goes more to the specific learning disability, and this was Congress's intent because we have the defect in psychological process, a part of the definition is that you can be sitting there, you can get information like everybody else, and the question is, are you retaining it? Are you processing it correctly? Again, there's no treatment. You could never eliminate it. You can't medically make it better. So you go to the discrepancy model because the question is whether or not you're getting the information you can then perform once you get information that way. And the discrepancy model works because it's saying.
Couldn't it be, though, it depends on the degree of the OHI? Because people could have it in different degrees, and a person could have an auditory processing disorder, but then it doesn't meet the other criteria. But a person could have it to the extent that it does meet the other criteria.
There's no precedent that I have seen that it causes a degree of lack of strength, vitality, and alertness that makes a student, because of their processing disorder, not able to access their education.
But isn't that, wouldn't that be fact-dependent? And it would depend on what the experts would testify to. And so all that the Department of Education is saying is it's not automatically rule. It doesn't say just because you have an auditory processing disorder, you get services under the OHI. It says but it can be analyzed under it.
Well, I think that does open a wide door that everything that you're looking in every other category should be considered under other health impairment. Going away from that theoretical back to this student, if you go back to our original
assessment. So is your concern you're going to have to give services to too many people?
Well, I think there's a concern that saying, and I'm not sure that this is what the government is saying, but that if you say you have a medical diagnosis of auditory processing disorder, you automatically qualify. What I
that's
hear them saying
what,
is you
but
still...
But they didn't say that.
Right, that's what I'm saying. You still need to go through the strength,
so
vitality, or alertness investigation. I'm just saying there's no cases that have ever found that to be the case. In my practical practice, there are no cases that we find that to be the case, that an auditory processing disorder makes a student so out of it the way that medical conditions are that they really can't pay attention in class, even with the treatment that they might be receiving from their doctors.
I just want to be sure I understand your position because I think I may be a little confused. I gather you say you do not necessarily disagree with the department when they say these various categories are not mutually exclusive.
Correct.
But I gather you're saying that that's not true of a central auditory processing disorder. You feel that could not be, given the nature of how an OHI is defined, it could not qualify, no matter what, as another health impairment. Is that your position?
That's my position, and I haven't seen any evidence in this case, either with this particular student.
I don't know where you're entitled to Chevron deference as an advocate and the Department of Education that's charged with administering the statute. They're in a different position than you are.
I still think we need to look. I'm sorry, did you have a question?
Do you understand the department? I'm a little confused about the department's. Do you understand the department's position to be that that this particular disorder has to be evaluated under both, or that the two statutes or the two categories are not necessarily mutually exclusive?
I hear them saying that's not mutually exclusive, and it could be. Not that you have to, not that you should automatically, when you see an auditory processing disorder diagnosis come across your desk, think OHI. And in this case, when you look at the original assessment in 2004, we have a section in there that talks about whether there's any known health or medical conditions, and that was checked no, because that wasn't how this student presented. Mm-hmm. He was coming to class. He had issues with completing work, paying attention sometimes, but he wasn't so physically impaired like you see with a medical condition that he couldn't access his education.
Well, that's okay. Why don't we move on to I think we understand your position. Why don't we move on to the 2004 hearing? Let's assume for this moment that we accept what the Department of Education says about how the statute can be interpreted. But then there's the 2004 hearing, and clearly that had not been articulated back in 2004. Is there any reason to remand this to look at it under that, or can we look at the record that we have before us and make that determination ourselves?
You absolutely can look at the record before you. It's what I argued to the district court in the first remand and the last remand. I believe it's in our brief as well, that the facts which presented this student's educational history, his performance in school, and all of the assessments that were available at that time didn't show that he had limited strength, vitality, and alertness that would qualify him under OHI. So absolutely, although it wasn't argued in briefs per se, the record is there that gives you a full picture of the student to make that determination.
What would be your position about whether we should make that determination or it should be remanded to make that determination on the record?
I would like to see the finality of this case. For one reason, I think that would be a preference to have this court look at it. And I think that the court said something in EM1, too, about the continued obligation of federal courts to implement the IDEA and make these decisions in a semi-de novo review. So I think it's in this court's purview, and it would be the preference that this court take the administrative record that's been laid out to it and that it could make that determination.
What's your position about, okay, you get more information about a student as it goes along, and let's say the child find situation. If the district does not find something, say, in third grade, but then by the time the child's in fifth grade, there's two additional years and other things and they decide that the child is entitled to services. Does that automatically mean that the district missed something back 2 years before?
No, absolutely not. I think that you articulated it in your question to the appellant that, you know, children are fluid objects, and a disability, what this court determined on EM1 is that he had an auditory processing disorder that was present at the time that we're looking at. So he has that condition. The question is, how does it manifest itself over time? And when we did the discrepancy testing, and we can get into whether we did that correctly, at that time he didn't qualify for a specific learning disability. As school gets harder, I would say that's probably the main concern. It may be that the gap widens as more difficult material happens. You go from a single classroom in elementary school to a chaotic middle school where you're changing classes all the time. Things get harder for students. And so
the disability doesn't really change, but the ability to compensate can change?
Exactly. And so that's the question with special education is, what degree of intervention do they need to help them with that compensation? It's also why a processing disorder is different. You don't leave it to the medical community to deal with. You leave it to the educational community to deal with. So if it gets to the point that it's so severe that they fall in their achievement so far below their intellectual ability, then they might need special education and the more intensive interventions. This is not a case also where the school ignored the student. They were trying multiple interventions with him all along the time period that we're talking about. So even though they had the diagnosis of auditory processing disorder, it wasn't like they left him to fend for himself.
Counsel, what's at stake for the parties in this case now? I mean, here we are in 2014. We're talking about a dispute that goes back to, I guess, school year 2004-2005. If we were to find, or if there were a finding, either here or perhaps below, that the child did not receive the special education services that should have been provided in that year, what follows from that? Are there compensatory educational services that would have to be provided, money to reimburse the parents for services that they had to provide?
There's no reimbursement issue in this case. Parents never expended their own funds.
Okay.
So really the only remedy to the student itself would be compensatory education, which I question is something he would even want. He's graduated from high school, indicated in his briefing that he intended to go into the military, which I've heard about for several years. For all I know, he's in the armed services right now. So, if he wanted tutoring and he received a positive award, I'm sure he could access that. I find that to be highly unusual once a student has left the school system.
Was it attorney's fees? Is that the issue?
I'm sorry.
Is it attorney's fees?
I believe that the attorney's fees in this case have grown to an astronomical amount, and it's a concern for the school district that a case like this would continue on for years. And that goes back to the question of supplemental evidence and these later assessments. It's really bothersome to the school district that on an eligibility case, which really is your snapshot case, looking at what you had at a particular point in time, that a student could continue on 3 and 4 years later getting new testing to try and prove a point from back here and keep a case open. Because, you know, every year it's hundreds of thousands of attorney's fees that the school district is facing if the student can keep the case open. And here we're saying keep it open even to a Pyrrhic victory at this point if he's not even going to access any services if he should prevail.
I don't have any additional questions.
Okay. Did you want me to speak to the decision of the district to use the lower intelligence score?
It's up to you.
Really the only issue I had.
You can use the time.
Okay. Very briefly, the standard that applies in this case is whether the district's decision to use a particular test score is reasonable. In special education, you're not allowed to rely on one testing measure to make an eligibility determination. Here there was multiple testing. The district had done 9 separate assessments. We had 2 assessments from the private assessor, Dr. Wright. And based on that information, the district court, the ALJ, both found that the decision to weigh the evidence that was before the school psychologist was reasonable. Plaintiff has made certain arguments throughout the brief that the school psychologist immediately thought the KABC was too high. I want to correct that interpretation. She really just saw that there was a disparity between the two intelligence numbers and wanted to administer a third. There was no predetermination that one was correct or not correct. We've never taken the position that they're not both valid tests, but in measuring IQ, a 7-point difference is significant. It's very rare that someone would move their intelligence number between 2 tests to that degree. And that's why she administered a 3rd test, did the correlation, which is spelled out in our briefs, and therefore made a reasonable decision in her discretion, and on that basis found no severe discrepancy.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Your Honors, just a couple of points. I'll cut to the chase. Page 38 all the way through 40 of our brief highlights years of academic struggles from EM. This wasn't a run-of-the-mill child who was just not doing his homework. The district knew that, and he had those problems since kindergarten, first grade, second grade, third grade. It wasn't until the parent got hold of an aide, and that's in the record, that the aide assisted this parent in getting help.
Well, can you answer my colleague's question? What's at stake here now?
Oh, sure. So I thought
other than I know what's at stake for the Department of Education, but what's at stake?
If I could just
for your client.
If I could supplement the record just with this piece of information, EM is 20. He graduated just over a year after he was supposed to graduate after failing almost all of his high school classes. He attempted to take the military exam and didn't have the skill set to pass. Compensatory education would be invaluable to a child who the district attempted to have 504 services for that failed, flatly failed, and this court found that. The court found that interventions attempted did not work. Therefore, this is no surprise that EM should have been deemed eligible. The compensatory educational remedies.
Since he was determined eligible at some point, how would going back to 2024, how would that change the services he's entitled to?
Well, I have, in preparation for today, I've prepared a lot of cases, and the Department of Education has also highlighted that just because a child graduates doesn't mean they're not entitled to compensatory education. That's because the child was not served, and he fell further and further behind.
But wouldn't that he be entitled to that anyway, regardless of this case, if what you're saying is true? How would winning this case change that calculus?
Well, unfortunately for EM, that is the sad travesty of this case, is that he wasn't served when he should have been served. And by the time he got to sixth grade, he was struggling so much so that, as Dr. Jacques clearly stated, but the court was hyper-focused on other parts of her report, Dr. Jacques clearly explained that the cumulative failure caused a wider gap.
Counsel, this could be another very complicated factual question. We're talking about one year in this case where arguably EM did not receive the educational services that should have been provided. Shortly after this year at issue, those services were provided throughout the rest of EM's education. Isn't that true?
Well, that is true, but as...
Okay,
as,
if I might. So right. How would you, given that long history, how would you translate that 1 year, not to minimize, but that 1 year where EM did not get what EM should have gotten into some level of compensatory, appropriately compensatory educational services for someone who's now 20 and has had all these life experiences?
Well, it wasn't a year. It was actually part of third grade, fourth, and fifth, so it was approximately 2.5 school years. And how I would translate that is when a child or a student now remains in the educational system, for example, as they are entitled to under the IDEA, they receive things like vocational training. They can receive things like tutoring. They can receive things like the therapies for the auditory processing that Dr. Casper said that even adults can benefit from. So there are compensatory educational remedies that are part of the IDEA for children between, I should say, for young adults between the age of 18 to 22. And we would ask that those services, as if he were still a part of the school system, be provided to him approximately 2.5 years. I did want to address one very important point, if I may, in the maybe last 30 seconds that I have.
You're in overtime already. So just, the clock's going up.
Okay.
You're already a minute and a half over. 30 seconds. Wrap it up.
If the district allows Leslie Vial to do what she did, it would allow a school psychologist on a whim to use test scores to exclude children. That's what she did. We analyzed this so-called 6-point discrepancy and the 7-point discrepancy deeply in our briefs, and it's been argued since the due process hearing. So I don't want to go into that. There was no statistical validity, as Dr. Kaufman, a Yale professor who wrote these tests, wrote the WISC, and who also wrote the Kaufman, said you cannot do what she did. And if you allow that to happen, school psychologists and school districts who do not want to categorize children as eligible for whatever reason will be able to test a child ad nauseum until they can prove that their point is that the child isn't eligible. In this case, EM was disabled. He was failing. Interventions weren't working. The school knew that. At the end of the day, he's been left with nothing. And we are asking the court to award him something for the district's part in creating this widening of the gap and allowing them to have cumulative experiences of failure.
All right. Thank you both for your argument. This will stand submitted.